I am really highly emotional about being selected as Valentino's awardee, and even more being the first one. I thought of Valentino as my scientific father. I've learned from him, I hope, to look at the facts first and then make an opinion, and not have first an opinion and then look how I can filter the facts to fit it. I met Valentino first time around, how do I make this go away? No. In around 72, the late Hendrik van der Loos organized a workshop on cortical function in Lausanne. And there came this very big and vigorous person. There was no PowerPoints. There was an overhead projector. He put a slide of a pyramidal cell on the overhead projector, and Almut here would forgive me for finding this poor image. The images there were much richer in branches. And on top of it, another cell, and another cell, and another cell, and another cell. And pretty soon, I cannot do it on the PowerPoint, it was clear that you have a fantastic mesh of branches and cells and fibers going around. And as Valentino would say, some anatomists are like butterfly collectors. They find an extreme beautiful case and make a big noise about it. We ought to look on everything that's there, on the things which are mostly there, and then by quantitative analysis, try to see what can be done about this structure to understand its function. This approach stuck me like a bullet or cannon or something. I always say, the Bible tells us that when Adam and Eve ate from the fruit of knowledge, the forbidden tree of knowledge, you would think that after they ate it, they knew everything because this was the tree of knowledge. But that's not what the Bible tells us. It tells us they knew how to distinguish between good and bad. And I think this is our human nature. We can't, or very rarely, really generate new ideas and knowledge. But once we hear a good idea, we can distinguish, or once we hear an idea, we can distinguish if it's good or bad. And Breitenberg's idea about quantitative anatomy was clearly, for me, the best idea I ever heard about how you can go about cortical function. Next time I met Valentino was in Tübingen in around 1977, I don't remember the years. Carl Goetz invited me to Max Planck Institute there of Biological Cybernetics because he was interested in my method of finding small spikes in noise and discriminating among the shapes online. I gave there a lecture. I was not aware that Valentino is in Tübingen. And he came to me after the lecture fully excited because in the lecture I've shown, to my surprise, and I guess at that time everybody's surprise, that if you take two neighboring neurons and measure their activity simultaneously, you seldom see direct synaptic interaction among them. It was only 6 or 8 or 10% of cases that I was able to see. And that fit very well with his analysis of what happens when an axon shoots through a tree of dendritic branches, how likely it is to make a synapse. So he came to me all excited and say, "We must go out for dinner." I told him, "Sorry, but I was already invited by Carl Goetz, and I have to go with him." So he said, "Okay, so come with me." dragged me to his office and gave me this beautiful book on the texture of brain. Now, I think that anybody here must read this book if he wants to understand how anatomy can dictate our thinking about function. It's really, in my mind, a masterpiece where Valentino analyzes the visual ganglion of the fly, the cerebellum, and the cortex, shows very different principle of anatomical organization and very different principles of computations. Shortly after that minute, I got a letter from him inviting me to write a book for the series on studies in brain function. I was astonished, you know, somebody heard me for one talk and maybe talked with me for 10 minutes after that and inviting me to write a book. But of course I accepted, and since then we met many, many times, and we found that our thinking are going along similar lines, and every time I met Valentino I learned something new about brain and about how to study brain. And lately I'm quoting a lot the last point that I've learned from him in a meeting that Embo summoned, trying to understand how molecular biology can solve the question of how the brain works. And they invited Valentino, and he opened his talk by the following: every problem has the appropriate scale. You don't want to read the newspaper with a microscope. And this is something to remember if you see the trends of what's going on nowadays. One of the things that came out from Valentino's already in the texture of brain, and also later with his anatomical studies with Almuth and quantitative studies with Gunter Palm, was this issue of the white matter. Now, this is a horizontal section you all recognize for a human brain, and you all see why our ancestors thought that it was some kind of fruit, because it has a cortex, it has nuclei in the center, and it has the juice, which is the white matter, in the middle. Valentino pointed out in his book, and later on in many talks, that most of the neurons in the cortex are pyramidal cells, and they send their axon into white matter. So if there are about 10 billion neurons in the cortex, there must be about 10 billion fibers in the white matter. Yet what we usually talk about are only small quantities. For instance, the visual input is 1 million, the auditory is 50,000, the total somatosensory input is few millions. Similarly, corticospinal output is few millions. Corpus callosum, which is huge, is only 100 million. All of this is a small fraction of the 10 to the 10 fibers that are running in the white matter. And Valentino says, the cortex speaks mostly to itself. Now, as many of you know, I'm an electrophysiologist studying single neurons in monkeys for many years. And this finding or statement was always bothering me in the following sense. If 90-something percent of the input to the cortex is coming from other cortex, yet how come that 99% of the studies are just about the effect of sensory input on the cortex? What about the function of all the other 90-something percent of fibers? In my mind, this is the next serious question for physiology. Understand what most of this mass of fibers is doing. So, Tim, you don't have to worry. I'm not going to talk about feedforward networks. And I'm And I am maybe disappointing some of the audience. I'm not going to talk about what I have done many years up to now and sinfire chains and so on. I want to talk about how I think we can approach this problem. Now, locally, axons run in all directions, and Valentino already on the texture of brain pointed out that in the cortex, the nearby connections are governed by distance. But far-by connections through the white matter are ametric. A place is equally likely to connect to a faraway place as it is to a nearby place. We all know that faraway connections are in patches. I got this from Rafi Malach. There is an injection here of a little bit of horseradish peroxidase conjugated with a protein that goes in a forward transport. You see the massive local connections, but you see that there are also patches of connections at distance from the injection site. Some of the patches are strong, some of the patches are weak. This is in visual cortex of monkey, and Rafi did not study the entire cortical things, but there are tens of patches like this in the monkey. Here is from the beautiful book of Valentino and Almut on the cortex. This is a beautiful cut, horizontal cut, through the cortex, through the brain of a mouse. And they make a point that the cortex in all animals is actually more or less the same. You have the same structure. It starts with the old structure, the hippocampus goes into middle age structure, the entorhinal cortex, and then the new structure, which we usually call neocortex, but I think rightly Valentino called it isocortex. That's a question of belief, whether you should look at things as developed through phylogenesis or as they are in mammals. So you have all this structure there. You have the cerebellum. Just a side point, this dark thing are the granule cells, and there are about 10 times more neurons there than in the cortex. So when somebody tells you there are 100 billion neurons in the brain, it's true. But 90 billion are these granule cells, which are not very important for consciousness or for cognition functions. Anyhow, so everything they describe is the principles are the same in all mammals, and we can study the mouse just as well. When I saw this picture, Almut, I got struck, I mean. Something is wrong. So where is white matter? This is already the striatum, and this is already the cortex. You compare this again to the human structure. Look, the enormous amount of white matter and the very thin layer here of white matter between striatum and cortex. It's amazing. The difference is amazing. It must mean something very important about function. If most of this material in us is connecting cortex to cortex, most of our ability must be by interaction among many cortical areas. And that's what I'm going to pursue from now on in my talk. In a very nice little article, Valentino, on the brain size, number of neurons, and an exercise in synthetic neuroanatomy, have argued, again, I guess, because it appears already earlier, that the number of modules that the brain make one area connect to, if each area that connects to many others is like a module, maybe hypercolumn if you want in modern technology, the number of these modules grows like the square root of the number of neurons. So Almut have shown that in a mouse, each patch of cortex connect to something between 3 and 6 other places. Humans has about 1,000 times more neurons, and if this rule is correct, then means that each patch in our cortex can connect to 90 to 180 other patches. And I think this is the basic anatomical substrate through which we can do the fantastic things that we can do. We can connect many, many aspects of every situation, thought, feeling, whatever you wish, together to a united mental item or experience. So that's where the huge amount of white matter is needed, and that's where we are so much better than, say, a mouse. If you look on this picture and you try to look where are faces in this, or where is a face, is there a face? It's not local features. There are many mouses, many noses, many eyes, many silhouettes, but there is only one place where you see and would recognize quite fast a full face. How do we do something like this? You know, no computer can do this. It's only by connecting the input, the feature detection, the total knowledge, what is a face, to something united that you can get perceived that this is a face. But you also connect this with many more things. You probably guess that this face is of a female. She is smiling slightly. Her eyes are looking to the side, and so on. And if you know the person, there will be a lot more memories and experiences coming together. All these things together, they make our mental experience of recognizing a familiar face. They must be through interactions, through many, many, many places in the cortex. And this is what I would call the property of our brains, of property of compositionality. We can make up complex, real experiences by composing many, many elements together. So here is my question, you mean. Any mental activity depends on coordination of many cortical areas. Now we spoke what is the anatomical substrate for such coordination. These are the fibers in the white matter and the way that connect one place to many patches in other places and so on and so forth. What about the physiology? Here we are really standing, I believe, in vacuum. It's a shame. I, as a physiologist, I am ashamed to say that there are very little studies and extremely little knowledge about what is the evidence for such coordination. I'm going to speak about experiment in which there are no external time markers. The experiments have several tasks, like relax, play with your fingers, count down from 3001 in steps of seven, memorize a movie you have seen last week, things like that. And I will try to show how you can start and detect the moments in time in which different cortical regions become coordinated during such tasks. The reason I'm doing this, and this is something general, is that most of our current methods do not do just with timing. If you want to study response, you average over tens and tens of responses to get the average response. You don't see what happens for the single one usually. If you want to do correlation, you have to take stretch of time here and here to compute the correlation coefficient or the delayed correlation. If you want to speak of coherence, you have to take a stretch of time and do Fourier transform or wavelet analysis. It's not something that you can pinpoint instantaneously now. This and this and that did something. But in our brain, that's how it works. When I shift my gaze and recognize somebody there, instantly things come together. If you have a problem, you may think about it along, but then instantly, oops, you got the answer. These things are not studies. So I'm talking about experiment of this type because there's no external time markers that you can hang on to see something. I'm going to speak about measurement in people. Now, you all know me, or many of you know me, as electrophysiologist doing monkey experiments. But at my current age, it's really hard to run after monkeys. So I switched to people. And in people, you can measure EEG or MEG. Here is some analysis of differences, but I'll skip it. I'm speaking about MEG. So physics, whenever there is current, there is also magnetic field around. If the currents go this way, the magnetic field goes that way. So a magnetic encephalogram, most of you may know, is something that looks like this, a big hood. The subject has its head inside the hood. In the hood, you have many coils. They are all at about 4 degrees Kelvin, made of metal, which is superconducting at this temperature. And therefore, the variable magnetic fields cause currents in this coil. These currents are replicated here in a little transformer. And they affect the coupling between two other coils. And that, on the whole, can be measured by something that's called a squid. Properties of some superconducting quantum effects. And there is liquid helium here. All this is in vacuum, so everything here is in 4 degrees Kelvin. There are also some coils farther away used to reduce noise. But the main thing is that we have here 248 coils in our system that measure the magnetic field at 248 points around the head. Now, as I said, current methods of analysis are either average responses, which for magnetic field, they're called event-related fields and not event-related potentials, but they look the same, or Fourier analysis. All of these take many repetitions. I will not go into the examples that I prepared here because you know this. Now, we have in our institute this MEG, and I admit that I was really a little bit disappointed after we started to look at the results. Everything looks blurred in space, partly because these coils are some distance out of the head, and the activity is inside the head, so every coil sees a whole volume of tissue, and you can't resolve carefully what's happening inside. A colleague at US, Stefan Robinson, developed a method to spatially filter the activity that you record on these 248 sensors, magnetic sensors, and estimate, given a point inside the head, how would the current dipole in this point vary to elicit what you see in the head. Now, a big problem in something like this is that everything is active. And even if you have a spatial filter that can focus your attention on one point, there is a danger that correlation between activity in other points would appear as if they generate something in this point. And this method called a synthetic aperture magnetometry, SAM for short, is optimally in a linear form trying to get rid of whatever comes out from correlation. This method was recently enhanced not to evaluate what happens in one point, but to evaluate what happens in a group of points. And Stefan Robinson was kind enough to give us the software to do this. And with this, we came with the idea that we would like to go away. That we would like to use this technique to sort of localize activity as far as possible. What you see here is the following. The black stars are the positions of the sensors outside the head. The blue points are points on the head of the subject, so you can roughly estimate how they look. Here is the nose. We can select a point inside the head and build around it a little octahedron. You may be able to understand better how it looks if I move this thing a little bit in 3D. Okay, so the point of interest is the central point, but there are 6 points around it, and we try to solve this synthetic aperture with this synthetic aperture magnometry. What is the activity in all these 7 points? Now, the method is such that is trying to disregard correlations that come from faraway points. So this thing makes it sort of differential. The activity here is like a differential activity with relate to this envelope of octahedron, where the octahedron absorbs most of the effect of correlations from far away, and you are left more with activity inside this point as the point of interest. I'm going to show you a few data results to support the idea that this is what we do. First of all, we can try and put this point at different distances from into the brain from each sensor and see if we can resolve from this where would be the cortex. And this is the result. So again, the black points are the sensors, the blue points are the head, and this red mesh is where, without knowing the MRI, we guessed in the best way where is the cortex. And you see that for 90% of the cases, this is right. There are also, of course, some outliers like here. Okay, so this is one reason to believe that you get something good. The other thing is, I said, we thought of this taking the center without what's seeing in the surrounding octahedron as the activity of a point, as a way to get rid of external correlations. Here is a graph of how a correlation between 2 points depends on the distance between the points. If you just take the sensors, you get this graph. It starts somewhere here at 90%, more or less, and drops off. And only, I don't know, at 10 centimeters, it comes to about 0.4. 10 centimeters is a lot in the brain. If you do the simple sum and do the simple synthetic aperture magnometry and do the same thing, you get this curve. If you do this idea of differential measuring, differential with respect to correlation, you get this curve. So even nearby points are correlated only by 0.4, and it drops down to the minimum possible in this kind of measurements quite fast. So what we are getting is really more of a local activity in a point in the cortex. How does something like this look? So here are a few channels reconstructed. Now it's not magnetic field anymore. This is the current amplitude of the dipoles in the head. The units should be ampere meter or something like this. It looks like squiggles, like EEG. Anybody who is not used to look on EEG, it looks like just some kind of noise. But you can realize that there are also some other effects, like, for instance, here there is this gamma frequency spindle in few channels, but not in others, and so on. So you can see some events here. We make the following argument about these measurements. Whenever activity in two regions in cortex become coordinated, we learned from Valentino that cortico-cortical connections are excitatory. So when things in two places become coordinated, you expect to see excitation from A going to B and back from B going to A. It's going to bring up the activity. Now, as we have heard today, shortly after that, inhibition would kick in, and quench this increased activity back to normal. So you would expect to see a brief transient of activity whenever two or more regions become coordinated. So we are looking now for brief transients which are coordinated in several positions in the cortex. And you'll note that there's no averaging here, not over time, not over frequency, not over, I don't know what, cases and so on. You instantly here and here something like this happened, and again here and here in time, and here and there in time, and so on. So how do such transients look? Here is an enlarged piece of this activity. You can see, for instance, that here, these three channels have a brief transient together, but it's not in this channel or that channel. You can see that here, up going blue and green are together, and hip the down going blue and black are together, and so on. So you can see transients, short transients, that are coordinated among channels here and there quite a lot. So now we are... So now we want to look at them. So there are two issues. One is technical. How we detect these transients. And the other is physiological. Are they related to what the brain is doing? Let me take first the technical issue, because that's always easier to resolve. So we want to automatically detect this transient. We use a mechanism that we developed already some 45 years ago. We collect samples of such transients by eye. So the blue ones here are the samples. And I show you here only 8 or so, but I collected about 40 of them. I put them all pointing up to discriminate between them and the average of all of them, which is the red line, which I'm plotting pointing down. I must make a comment, side comment, whether the current is pointing in this direction or pointing in this direction is arbitrary, because first you decide what is the direction of the current dipole, and a positive current for direction that goes like this is identical like a negative current for a direction that goes like this. So the positive or negative amplitude of the current dipole is arbitrary. So we collected many of those. This is the average. If they all look the same, you can just use the average as a template, and this is the case here. If not, as some of you know, you can make, by principal components, a whole space of shapes, that linear combinations of which will describe your case. So, but here they are all similar. So this 7 points, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 points, capture the shape. We add another constant point. We make, for reasons that will be clear soon, we make the average of everything 0. We normalize the sum of square to be 1. So this is a unit vector in some 15-dimensional space. And we now want to find in our data when the data looks like this vector. Here is the math, and I don't want to go through it, but it's actually simple. For every point in time, you project the current, the cortical current dipole on this template. You get the signal size. You take the sum of squares, and that's the total power, if you wish, of these 15 points. The difference is this difference, and the ratio between is the signal-to-noise ratio. So we get ongoing two measures. That's the main point. One, how similar is what we recorded to the template, and two, how big is the signal-to-noise ratio at this point? And that goes for every sample along the data. So the thing would look something like this. Do I have to finish? At some point I will. What would be the norm?
Plus 5.
Plus 5, thank you. Okay. So here's how it looked. The blue trace is the recording. The green thing is the projection on the template. The red thing is the signal to noise, each with different scales, so don't compare them. There are thresholds. If the projection on the template is big and the noise is above its threshold, we call it an event. If not, not. So on. And these thresholds are adjusted so that we have about 3 waves per second on the average for each trace. So are they related? So this is how we detect them. Are they related to behavior? Here is the idea. We divide each behavior. We have relaxation, counting down to 3001, and so on. We divide it into pieces. One is used as a training set, the other is a refining set, and the last is the test set. Patterns of these events that repeat twice in the training set are candidates for important patterns. We further refine them by taking only those that repeated also in the refining set, and then we look how many times they occurred in the test set. So for each behavior, there are 6 behaviors in this experiment. For each task or each behavior, there is a set of patterns of coincidences of these blips in different places that we think are specific to this behavior, and we try to see how many times these specific patterns that we got for behavior J are in the test set from behavior I, and we sort this test set as belonging to task J if it has more of the specific patterns from extracted for behavior J. Then we randomly shuffle the data in another way. We repeat it again and again 100 times, and we get a confusion matrix. That is, we know that this test set come from one behavior. What is the probability that it was assigned to this very behavior or to behavior number 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6? So if everything is fine, you want to see big numbers along the main diagonal and small numbers everywhere else. This is not life. Life is not so easy. So this is how the confusion matrix look. Behavior 1, relaxation, looked somewhat like behavior 1, not like 2 and 3, but again like 4 and 5 and 6, and so on. Is this completely random? No. Is this nice as you would hope for? Also no. But there are some interesting features here. The behaviors were first a relaxation period, then playing with the right-hand movement, then playing with the left-hand movement, then counting down at steps of 7, then memorizing a movie, and then relaxation again. You see that the relaxation looks most similar to the second relaxation. Also, the second relaxation looks most similar to the first relaxation. So here, confusion can be expected. The relaxation also looks like this internal brain activity of counting down or memorizing, but not like motor movements. The motor movements are confused among themselves, but not with the other states. And also, the two mental tasks are confused among themselves and with the relaxation task. So this is not random. It makes some sense. It's not beautiful, meaning I'm in Germany on sabbatic this year, so I have what to do here. So in conclusion, what I've shown you, that there are possibilities to study inter-areal coordination in a precise time scale without averaging of any form. And I believe this opens the possibility for studying the process of binding in the whole brain for different mental situations. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Moshe. I understand there is time for a few questions. Over there in the back. Yes.
Thanks for the talk. I wondered about the number you introduced in the beginning from Valentino Breitenberg, that the number of connected areas should be around the square root of n. So now you found this characteristic pattern. Did you ever check where this corresponds roughly to the estimated and predicted number?
So what Breitenberg did is calculated for different animals how the volume of the white matter would fit different models of connectivity between cortical areas. And the model that fitted best for several animals, the volume of the white matter with the number of neurons was this square root of n. It was not done for men, but for several animals. I'm afraid that there are no direct measurements which could be done, like Almut did beautifully in the mouse, for other animals to show that it really holds in patches. All I can say that in a monkey that should be about 10 times more than in the mouse from data of Rafi Malach, but informally it looks that it is that order of magnitude more. But this is only a general idea and not a proven fact.
Any other questions? Let me ask a question. So far you were counting these numbers of events, right? The ones that you isolated using all these techniques. What about the timing of them? Did you look at that?
I started to look, and there were so many I got overwhelmed. I mean, my computer got overwhelmed. So I concentrated on things that happened together within 2.5 milliseconds.
Yes.
And I thought, first I see something good there, and then I go and widen it. So this is in the program of doing.
Okay, thanks. If there is no more question, I think the next issue is coffee. Thanks again.
Thank you.